Translation. Ganesh. Mamata very much feared being forsaken by her husband for giving birth to an illegitimate son, and therefore she considered giving up the child. But then the demigods solved the problem by enunciating a name for the child. Purport. According to Vedic scriptures, whenever a child is born, there are some ceremonies known as Jatakarma, and Namkarana, in which learned Brahmins, immediately after the birth of the child, make a horoscope according to astrological calculations. But the child to which Mamata gave birth was begotten by Brihaspati irreligiously. For although Mamata was the wife of Utatya, Brihaspati made her pregnant by force. Therefore, Brihaspati became Bharta, or husband. According to Vedic culture, a wife is considered the property of her husband, and a son born by illicit sex is called Dvaj. The common word still current in Hindi society for such a son is dogla, which refers to a son not begotten by the husband of his mother. In such a situation, it is difficult to give the child a name according to proper regulative principles. Mamata, therefore, was perplexed. But the demigods gave the child the appropriate name, Bharadvaj, which indicated that the child born illegitimately should be maintained by both Mamata and Brihaspati. Next verse. Brihaspati said to Mamata, "You foolish woman, although this child was born from the wife of one man through the semen discharged by another, you should maintain him." Upon hearing this, Mamata replied, "Oh, Brihaspati, you maintain him." After speaking in this way, Brihaspati and Mamata both left. Thus the child was known as Bharadvaj. Next verse. Although encouraged by the demigods to maintain the child, Mamata considered him useless because of his illicit birth, and therefore she left him. Consequently, the demigods known as the Maruts maintained the child. And when Maharaj Bharat was disappointed for want of a child, this child was given to him as his son. What? Louder, please. She didn't change the numbers. Don't be disturbed. It's all right. So this is the end of the chapter, and we're hearing some unusual things from Shukadev Goswami. Yesterday, we heard that Shukadev told Parikit Maharaj that Maharaj Bharat had three pleasing wives. And when all three of them bore children who did not resemble King Bharat, these wives thought that Bharat would consider them unfaithful queens and reject them. And therefore the wives killed their own sons. Srila Prabhupada doesn't comment on this, but I was wondering, what might he say if we asked him about that? It's a crime to kill a child within a year or so of its birth. It's called infanticide, killing a baby. And it seems to be a weak relationship if the queens wouldn't be able to explain to their king, to their husband, the king, that really the children are his. Why wouldn't the queens be able to establish the truth? So it's kind of, it sounds weird that they killed these three children. What do you think? Yes, Gora? Please, maybe what?
They weren't the king's sons.
Oh.
If they were very young, you can't really tell whether they looked like him. So maybe they were different colors or something like that.
Maybe they were what?
They were different, had a different complexion, skin complexion.
But that would not make them not the king's sons. Yes, it's possible they did not look like the king. What else do you think about this? Cannot speculate, therefore we cannot say anything. You approach an authority. So one possibility is to look in the commentaries to this verse. Maybe some acharyas made a comment on this verse, although Prabhupada didn't. That's one way to find out more.
That's why it's called infanticide. A separate crime.
Okay.
It's a very much reduced penalty and a very much reduced it's not considered as serious as.
Okay. Smarhari says sometimes the mother's unbalanced after giving birth, and the courts consider this, if she kills the child, less than unusual murder is of a child. I didn't know that. I thought of two other aspects of this infanticide that we could consider. Can anybody else? I want to, maybe you have some suggestions how to consider this. Discrepancy.
Suggestion that she was less than chaste, then this would give license to people to. So it may have been for any number of reasons that they took the life of the children, including that they wanted to uphold the king's good name. So it may not have been so much that very interesting for me that there was suggestion or the possibility of this sort of thing, although it's not a modern phenomenon.
Okay, again, Smarhari said that the queens might have thought that because the king upholds high standards, if there's any suspicion that these children are not his, then he'll be defamed. So they may have had their reason for doing it. Anybody else? I could think of at least two more things. No, somebody else. Yes. They didn't want to be removed from their position. Yes, it's possible. Just greediness on their part for their position. Last chance. Anybody have another thought?
Any ladies would like to come?
Any parallels? Can anybody think of any parallels in Krishna's pastimes? What? Yes. Yes, Kamsa killed many newborn babies, and Devaki in particular lost 6 children. Why? Those boys were all cursed to die as soon as they were born. They had this. So it's possible that these 3 children may have also had some karma, and that was part of the reason that they were murdered by their mothers. One other thing. How does this chapter start? Or in the middle, what's going on in the middle? Dushmanta impregnates Shakuntala. He has a nice son. She has a nice son named Bharat. It's Dushmanta's son. He grows up to be 5 or 10 years old, away from the father, and when Shakuntala brings him to the court, he says, this may not be my child. Certainly nobody here in the kingdom knows this is my child. What should I say? Then what happens? A voice from the sky speaks the truth. Dushmanta, this is your child. You should maintain him, and you shouldn't insult Shakuntala. So it's conceivable that if King Bharat had said to his wives, these must not be my children, these 3 sons, they don't look like me, it's conceivable that a voice from the sky could have intervened. Again, it happened to his father. So those are some thoughts on these murders.
Infanticides.
Now this voice in the sky was saying to Dushmanta, you have to claim your son. But here at the end of the chapter, we find that in the heavenly planets, Brihaspati ignored this advice. In fact, it's a Vedic injunction. The father has to claim his son as his own. So Brihaspati, the father of this boy who becomes named Bhardwaj, ignores this instruction. Even though this is at the end of the chapter, and in the middle of the chapter we're reading that Dushmanta had to follow this injunction. So this gives us some idea of how sometimes events don't follow the pattern that we would expect. When Dushmanta is told to claim his son, he follows the advice, and this unites him with Shakuntala and Bharat. This whole chapter has been a description of a dynasty started by Puru, and it includes the saintly devotee, Rantidev. Rantidev is the grandfather of Dushmanta. We heard the story in this chapter that Dushmanta was hunting, and he approached the ashram of a sage named Kanva, where he saw this extremely beautiful woman, Shakuntala, and became attracted to her. I saw this pastime performed as a drama in Sanskrit, in the Sanskrit language, about 30 years ago in Ujjain. Ujjain is the place where Kalidas lived. Kalidas is India's famous dramatist. He's sometimes called the Shakespeare of India. He lived in Ujjain. So Ujjain sometimes holds a festival to celebrate the Sanskrit literary arts. And that's where I saw this play. About 30 years ago, Tamal Krishna Maharaj had written a drama. Our Tamal Krishna Maharaj wrote a drama about Lord Jagannath using the guidelines for a Sanskrit drama, although he wrote it in English. And at that time, 30 years ago, I was a little bit involved with him, I learned about this drama in Ujjain. So I went there to see what was going on, and I saw this play of Shakuntala. It was performed at night under the open sky, and there were live musicians on the stage. So it opens up in the same way that the description in the Bhagavatam opens up. The king approaches Kanva's ashram. Sri Hari, you have to listen if you're going to sit here. No talking. The king approaches Kanva's ashram on a chariot drawn by horses. So in the drama, several actors are playing the horses. And one actor is playing Dushmanta. And the musicians are on the side of the stage providing some percussion that resembles the movement of the horse's hooves. And the actors move in such a way that they look like horses of the chariot. They move together. And the king moves in a coordinated way behind them, as if they're moving on a chariot, although they're just on their feet. But, you know, they create the effect of a chariot being drawn. So it was really quite a wonderful play to see. And in the Sanskrit language, I couldn't understand everything, of course, but the events in the narration make for a good drama. He sees an extremely beautiful woman, becomes attracted to her. We learn that Shakuntala, the beautiful woman, is the daughter of a heavenly damsel who seduced the sage Vishvamrita. And the mother of Shakuntala left her in this world. She returned to the heavenly kingdom. And Kanva Muni brought the child to his ashram and raised her. I'm not sure what happened to Vishvamrita Muni, the father. So anyway, when Shakuntala meets Dushmanta, we read in the verses of this chapter, they accept one another as husband and wife, and then they produce a son, and the king returns to his palace. And he kind of forgets about the whole thing. 5 or 10 years go by, and then Shakuntala comes to the palace with the son. And Kalidas describes it in a little different way than the Bhagavatam about this forgetting, the king's forgetting. But in any event, here it's described that a voice from the sky declared the truth. Maharaj Dushmanta, the son actually belongs to you. Therefore, maintain your son. And everyone could hear the voice, so the king no longer had a problem with the fact that people might not know that this is actually his wife and his son. The people now understood, so he accepted Shakuntala. But then in the upper planets, when Brihaspati has a son, this instruction is ignored by Brihaspati. So, let's consider this. There's a similar, you know, the thing that's said in the Bhagavatam is similar, that the son, the father must accept the son. It's similar to a Vedic injunction, which is actually given in the 10th canto, the verse, the Vedic injunction that the father must accept the son. And the whole verse is given in the 10th canto in connection with the pastime of Lord Balaram. The Vedic injunction is that Atma vai putra namasi. The father becomes the son. The father's son is him in a sense. One's self is born by the son. When one has a son, one's own self is born. The son is considered to be one's own self. So Balaram refers to this Vedic text himself. After killing Ramaharshan, there was a sage named Ramaharshan speaking on the Puranas in an assembly of sages, Ganesh. And when Balaram appeared among the sages, the sages stood up to honor Balaram. But Ramaharshan was thinking, I'm the speaker, I'm the presenter of the Puranas, I don't have to get up to honor the personality of Godhead. And for this offense, Balaram killed him with a blade of grass, kusha grass, just by touching him with a blade of grass. Then the sages in Balaram held a discussion what to do next, how to replace Ramaharshan so that the recitation of the Puranas could continue. And Balaram then said, the Vedas instruct us that one's own self takes birth again as one's son. Thus, let Ramaharshan's son become this next speaker of the Puranas, and let him be endowed with a long life, strong senses, and stamina. So this is where, in Sridhar Swami's commentary on Balaram's pastimes, Sridhar Swami quotes the whole Vedic verse. Angad angad sambhavasi hridayad abhijayase atmavai putranamasi sanjeeva saradasatam. You have taken birth from my various limbs and have arisen from my very heart. You are my own self in the form of my son. May you live through 100 autumns. May you live through 100 autumns, or live 100 years. This appears in what's called the Satapatha Brahman and the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. So it's part of the Vedas. So we expect the members of Vedic society to follow it, but here at the end of the chapter, this advice is ignored by Brihaspati. Now, it's not so difficult probably to understand Brihaspati's state of mind. He's not in a very sober state of mind. He's impregnated Mamata forcibly when she was pregnant, which is so unusual that even the child in the womb protested. And how this could happen, that another pregnancy could take place. The first son comes out, and then later another son. So Brihaspati wasn't, he was so lusty, he wasn't in a state of mind to accept the son. So we might say then that this is somehow an arrangement made by providence, made by the Lord. Child is rejected by both Brihaspati and Mamata, and therefore the Maruts, the demigods, the Maruts, give the child a name indicating that he's an illegitimate son, and they start to raise him. But they learn that King Bharat has been frustrated in having a son because three wives have killed his three sons. And he's performing a sacrifice to get his son, Bharat. So the demigods become aware of his desire to have a son, and they feel satisfied with him because he's doing his sacrifice. So they present him this son named Bharadvaj. So this is a very, very complicated pastime, but somehow it is a pastime of a partial incarnation of the personality of Godhead. Normally we expect, you know, in the Vedic culture that things will be very regulated and everything will be in order. But sometimes things happen that are really out of line, that don't meet the Vedic expectations. Krishna himself is referred to by this word Bharata, the supporter, the maintainer, the husband, in the Bhagavad Gita. Just to give you the idea of how this sense of society being properly ordered is, Krishna uses the word to describe himself. In the ninth chapter, he says, Gati Bharata, I'm the goal, I'm the sustainer. And again in the 13th chapter, he calls himself the Bharata, the master, the supporter of this world. So Krishna says he's the father of all living entities, and he says if I didn't work, the whole world would become disordered. So he's expected to maintain and support everything. And there's another sense in which the word Bharata used in the Chaitanya Charitamrita refers to Nityananda Balaram in his features Karna Dakshai Vishnu, lying on the causal ocean. In that role, he's the master of the material energy, the shelter of all the universes. So this word Bharata has this implication that one who is the father or the husband has to carry the progeny, he has to support and maintain the progeny. And when we think of Krishna in that role as Karna Dakshai Vishnu, or Balaram Nityananda in that role as Karna Dakshai Vishnu, we get a sense of the Lord's exalted position. We can actually name and identify the personality who is the master of the material energy. This is something that most other religions cannot do very specifically. Prabhupada said that the other religionists cannot tell us the name and address of the Supreme Lord, but we can find this out from the Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita and Chaitanya Charitamrita. Because they cannot be so specific in identifying the master of the universe, other religionists don't offer as much bhakti. There may be some devotion in their relationship to God, but they can't offer as much devotion as devotees can, because devotees know the personal form and the qualities and the names of the Lord. And then what to speak of religionists with just a little knowledge of the Lord. The so-called followers of religions, those who are just nominal followers of the world's religions, you know, they say they're a member of a particular religion, but they live in almost total forgetfulness of God. They have no conception day by day of their relationship with God. They just, in the back of their mind somewhere, God exists for them as a concept, we could say. So we're learning very specifically about the personality of Godhead. As long as we continue to read Prabhupada's books, we learn. And even though there are sometimes unusual occurrences, as we read in this chapter, still there are ways to understand how things can sometimes be very unusual. Any questions?